The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events here at the Free Library, and I want to welcome you. The work of legal scholar and sociologist Dorothy Roberts addresses myriad issues of social justice, policing, science, and state surveillance of families. Her books include the foundational text, Killing the Black Body, Race, Reproduction, and the Meaning of Liberty, Shattered Bonds, The Colored of Child Welfare, and Fatal Invention, How Science, Politics, and Big Business Recreate Race in the 21st Century. Roberts is the George A. Weiss University Professor of Law and Sociology at the University of Pennsylvania, where she directs the Penn Program on Race, Science, and Society. In her latest book, Torn Apart, she explains that the abolition of the U.S. child welfare system, which she shows is designed to punish black families, will liberate black communities. Tonight, Professor Roberts will be in conversation with Mark Lamont Hill, the Steve Charles Chair in Media Cities and Solutions at Temple University, and the author of six books, including Beats, Rhymes, and Classroom Life, Nobody, Casualties of America's War on the Vulnerable, From Ferguson to Flint and Beyond, and Except for Palestine, The Limits of Progressive Politics. He's the owner of Uncle Bobby's Coffee and Books, a community bookstore in Germantown, which is also the bookseller for this series. Please join me in welcoming Dorothy Roberts and Mark Lamont Hill to the Free Library.
Good evening, everybody. I am so excited to talk about this wonderful book with such a wonderful, brilliant colleague and scholar. Dorothy, thank you so much for doing this.
Oh, thank you, Mark, for this conversation, taking time out of your busy schedule. I really appreciate it.
Oh, no, it's my honor. I've long been a fan of your work, and so to have the opportunity to talk and engage directly is really wonderful to me. It almost feels like a cliche question, but I always ask it because I think it matters. It's always the why this book, why now question.
Mm-hmm.
Why this book, why now?
Mm-hmm. Well, I wrote a book on this topic 20 years ago called Shattered Bonds, The Color of Child Welfare, right after I discovered that this system called the child welfare system was actually a big state apparatus that monitors black communities and takes children away and relies on that kind of terror in families to operate. That was actually right after I was finishing up my book, Killing the Black Body. And that book was about the regulation of black women's childbearing. And mostly I was focusing at the time on the prosecutions of black women. And then I discovered that thousands and thousands of them were having their newborn babies taken from them because of a positive drug test. And also because of the myth of the so-called crack baby, which turns out to be a complete lie. And I wanted to document this huge racial inequity in the child welfare system. And so I wrote that book, and then I worked in reforming the system for 20 years after that. And we can talk about later about all the kind of work I was doing, training social workers. I worked in a big class action lawsuit as an expert to try to reform foster care in Washington State, which had been held to be violating the constitutional rights of foster children in the state, and lots of other articles, you know, lots of ways. And I discovered after 20 years of this work trying to reform the system, it basically had stayed the same, in the sense that it continues to be a system that relies on threatening to take the children of the most politically marginalized communities in America, especially black communities and indigenous communities. So nothing had changed in terms of the foundational design of the system. And so it continues to terrorize families and injure children who are placed in a so-called foster care system that harms many children, especially black children. And so part of it was my realization that there had to be something more than these reforms. The other thing why I think it's very timely is not just because the suffering it inflicts continues, but also because there's been a real increase in a movement to abolish it. And alongside the movement to abolish the prison industrial complex, which is much larger, much well known, there is this burgeoning smaller movement to dismantle the child welfare system, really ignited by black mothers who've been involved, and also more and more youth who've been involved in foster care who recognize its harms and want to dismantle it and replace it with something different. And so I was more familiar now with abolitionist principles, you know, having read and advocated for the abolition of the prison industrial complex. And so I had a better vision of what actually needs to take place, yeah, which is to end this system and work toward an approach, a society that actually supports families and actually keeps children safe, which this system doesn't do.
That's such an important point you make. Shattered Bonds is a wonderful book. And there's this idea sometimes that scholars, as they develop in their work and move throughout their careers, that they get less radical. But you didn't do that.
No.
You went from a critical analysis of the system to an abolitionist response.
Yeah.
In this text.
That's right.
Yeah. And you talk about saying that there's this big movement to abolish the prison industrial complex, mm-hmm, and then there's a smaller movement around the child welfare system. But I think one of the interesting things about your book, mm-hmm, is that you don't really separate those two things. You talk about how it's bound up in the prison industrial complex in so many ways. It's a criminalizing,
right,
system.
Absolutely. So that is also something I came to be more aware of over those 20 years that I didn't really write about in Shattered Bonds, which is the way in which this so-called child welfare system, which I call a family policing system because that's really what it does, that it is deeply entangled with criminal law enforcement and prisons, and entangled both in the principles that animate them. They're both systems that, first of all, are deeply involved in segregated black communities. That's where they're both concentrated. So in cities like Philadelphia, Chicago, New York, San Francisco, you know, wherever you go, you'll find that the vast majority of child welfare cases are in black communities, other than areas where there's native children. And there, there is this concentration of child welfare agency involvement with, you know, native tribes or indigenous children. So that's one similarity, the communities that are targeted. But another is the principles behind them. So they both look to punitive means that are targeted at the most disadvantaged, politically disenfranchised groups in order to solve social problems, you know, in order to meet human needs, yeah, in order to resolve conflict. So instead of getting to the roots of why we have violence in our society, why there are children with unmet needs, it blames the people who are most disadvantaged by the structures that are actually causing these unmet needs and punishes them in some way. In the case of prisons and police, you know, it's arrest, it's incarceration, caging people for years on end, even for minor petty offenses that don't really harm anybody. But it's also a way, of course, of dealing with more violent offenses, but it hasn't worked. And we know that prisons don't respond to crime, or they have other political reasons why they expand. And so that's very similar to the child welfare system and foster care. very similar histories. I mean, that the expansion mirrors each other perfectly. So the expansion of the foster care system is at the exact same time that we see the expansion of the prison system. And as more and more black families became involved, or black people became involved in both of these systems, we see them becoming more punitive. That historical parallel is perfect. And we can delve into the history even more. But they also work hand in hand. It's not just that they operate in similar ways, accusing, prosecuting, punishing, but they also work hand in hand. So caseworkers, for example, especially when they go into black neighborhoods, frequently bring police officers with them to scare families into letting them into their homes without any kind of legal protections, without enforcing the Fourth Amendment, which applies, by the way, to any search of a government official of a home. It's not just police, caseworkers. And by the way, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court recently held that caseworkers cannot go into people's homes based on an anonymous tip to a child abuse hotline without first getting a warrant. And by the way, that decision was based on the work of a housing activist in Philadelphia. Jennifer, and I hope I'm pronouncing her last name right, Benetch, is anybody here? No, Jen? I spoke with her in working on Torn Apart, and she very tragically passed away of COVID recently. Yeah, but just to give you an example, if it's okay to expand a little bit.
I was going to ask you to give the example because I think people need to visualize how this happens. And just really quickly, part of the reason is because we've always taken for granted that when the state comes, especially if they come in for your kids, that you got to let them in. You got to let them look through your bedroom, check the refrigerator, look under the bed. I mean, these are things that person after person says is just part of the norm.
Let's add strip searching your children because they're looking for evidence that you've abused them, even when the allegation has nothing to do with abuse. Most allegations are about neglect, children in need. So what happened to Jen was she was protesting in front of the Philadelphia Housing Authority, and someone called in a tip. Now, it could have been someone who didn't like her protesting in front of the housing authority. This is one of the ways in which the child abuse hotline often gets used as a way of retaliating against people. And so someone called in a tip to the child abuse hotline saying that this woman had been protesting in front of the Philadelphia Housing Authority for 8 hours, and it wasn't clear if she had fed her child who was there with her. Okay, no allegation or evidence she had done any harm to her child, not even evidence that she hadn't fed her child, but just that it wasn't clear had she fed her child.
I didn't see him eating.
Exactly. So the CPS sends a caseworker to her house later to investigate. And see, she's an activist, so she knows. And she, you know, her activism has tied together the housing crisis in Philadelphia and the taking of children in Philadelphia, housing insecurity being one of the main reasons why children are taken and put in foster care, because this system doesn't provide housing for people. Okay, so she knows about the system. That's what we talked about when I spoke with her last year. And so she said, no, you can't come in. So what do? They bring a police officer with them next time. And she still refuses. They go to court and get a trial judge to order her to let them in her house. And this went all the way up to the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania, largely because of her work. I was told that she drafted the briefs and everything.
Oh, that's her. She was a fierce activist.
Right. So, and by the way, also give a shout out to Community Legal Services and the ACL. Yes. And the ACLU of Pennsylvania, who drafted an amicus brief pointing out the racism in this system. And the Pennsylvania Supreme Court held that it violated her Fourth Amendment rights to insist on entering her home without probable cause. There was no probable cause here. This was based on an anonymous tip, which often happens. Mostly it's mandated reporters who report. But also anonymous tips can trigger an investigation, as we see here. And there was no backup for this investigation. Anybody could call and just make something up, right? And that shouldn't be a reason why government agents can come search your home. And then secondly, searching her home was irrelevant to whether she had fed her child while she was engaged in protest. So there has to be a nexus between the two. This is standard constitutional law. But standard constitutional law doesn't get applied in the case of family policing. And this is one of the also connections with police, which is they get a pass if they go along and enter a house now with caseworkers. They don't think they need a warrant. They don't get a warrant. They would have needed a warrant in most cases if they were investigating a crime. But there is this, in effect, exemption that's made for child protection because of the idea that it's necessary to protect children. But this idea that they're on a mission to protect children can't be a waiver of our constitutional rights, but that's how it's treated.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, it's happening to the most vulnerable people. You said
it only happens to them. Yeah. Do you think that if you show up at the house of a wealthy person, who, by the way, they also may not feed their children, you know? They may not have food in the refrigerator,
right?
You know? Because they're going to call, you know, Uber Eats.
Exactly.
I do that all the time.
I've been known to do that, yeah.
know. You know, they may, but, you know, seriously, they have lapses as well. They use drugs. In fact, some of them boast about using drugs and drinking while caring for their children. Literally, you know, there was a piece in the New York Times where someone wrote that during COVID, people on her chat talk about how they are turning to alcohol in order to manage their children at home because they're too stressed to take care of their children. Well, a statement like that by an impoverished black mother in Philadelphia would be seen as making her unfit to take care of her children. And so there's this double standard as well. So we should be clear where they show up. If they show up in the rare occasions at the home of a wealthy person, that person is going to call their lawyer. And I've had caseworkers tell me, part of the reason we don't go into wealthy communities is because we know we're going to encounter lawyers, and so why bother?
Right. Too much hassle.
Too much work. Yeah. Too much work. Let me just mention one other thing, that even if we acknowledge the Fourth Amendment protections, the main reason why families let caseworkers into their homes to investigate, inspect, and then, by the way, that's just the first part. They then go on to investigate every aspect of the private lives. And that's being expanded by digital surveillance as well, you know, where they hire big corporations to collect massive amounts of data on families and do this automated decision making where they predict, you know, supposedly where children are going to be harmed in the future and send caseworkers to those homes. And as you probably know about digital surveillance with police and other institutions, it's deeply racist. The data is embedded with racial inequality. The algorithms use factors that are discriminatory against poor people and black people and other marginalized people. So all of this expanded surveillance is going on in the poorest communities, especially black and indigenous communities.
You said something in the book that I'm not going to say it as elegantly, as artfully as you did, but you effectively said that you knew this was a problem. You know the child welfare system is a problem because white people don't access it.
Right.
And that there are just no social resources or goods in this country that are good that aren't overly consumed.
Yes, exactly. So, I mean, I want to be clear, there are white children involved in the system, impoverished white children. Very few wealthy white children would ever, regardless of what's going on in their home. And again, let's be honest, there are children in wealthy homes who have eating disorders, who have suicidal ideation,
Absolutely.
Whose parents neglect them in various ways. But they aren't the people the system is designed to target. It is designed for impoverished people.
That's where I want you to go, because I think for some it's just hard to wrap their minds around this. You know, we have lots, and this isn't exceptional. I mean, we have, whether it's the war on terror or the war mm-hmm. on drugs, these mm-hmm. things all sound good. Right? But,
yeah.
but when we unpack them, right. we understand that they do something else.
Yeah.
Child welfare.
Yeah.
Couldn't sound more helpful.
Right. Right.
Right?
Yeah.
How do we get to the point where this system is constructed that is ostensibly to protect the welfare of children, but ultimately ends up separating, surveilling, criminalizing, punishing, traumatizing? How do we get there?
Yeah. Well, we've gotten there over 400 years of U.S. history. So I think to understand how we get here, we have to go all the way back to the enslavement of black people and the way in which family separation was an integral part of the slavery system. Of course, white enslavers had total authority over the children of black parents. Total authority. They legally owned their children from the moment of conception. And so they could do whatever they wanted. They could send children off to another enslaver, and they frequently did. On the auction block, which was orchestrated and governed by judges could order the sale of parents separate from their children. You know, the father could go one to one plantation, the mother to another. Each child could go to a separate plantation. So there was the separation of families that was part of the slavery system, an essential part of the slavery system. I think we need to go all the way back there because it sets up this idea that black children are better off under the supervision of white people, that black families don't have tight bonds that are harmed when you take children away from them. The idea that black children are better off anywhere, you know, anywhere except for in their communities. I'm not making up these ideas. These ideas have been found to be in case files, in decision making, studies that show the bias of doctors and social workers and teachers in identifying when a child is at risk. You know, studies that show that caseworkers see a harm when there is a black child in a photo as opposed to a white child in a photo with exactly the same background. Multiple studies that show this. And so where does this idea come from? I think it comes all the way back to from slavery. But I'm not arguing that it's just slavery that caused this. We can see generation after generation policies that have devalued the bonds of black families. And even after emancipation, and this is where I think is the actual origin of the formal child welfare system for black children, there was, as you probably are aware, a white supremacist move to reinstate slavery and to reinstate the power of white people.
Yeah.
In the South, you may have heard of the black codes that were passed to criminalize aspects of everyday black life so that black people would be incarcerated, they could be put on chain gangs to work, they could be even leased out to coal mines and railroads and factories to work. And they were literally worked to death in these places. Well, part of the black codes and this effort to reinstate white supremacy was to use apprenticeship laws or to pass new apprenticeship laws that put black children back into work for their former enslavers. And this happened in courts where white people would bring petitions to say that black families weren't taking care of their children, that the children were neglected, and that the children would be better off under the supervision of their former enslavers. And thousands upon thousands of black children were sent by judges back into work to labor for white former enslavers. That is, you know, of course, it's not exactly what goes on now, but there are aspects of it. The idea that black children should be supervised by others than their families. The idea that courts can use neglect statutes in order to separate black families. Those basic ideas that were present in the apprenticeship system we could see today. And then we can continue, you know, throughout the 20th century with this convergence of ways in which the Black community has been assaulted by various punitive state systems, like the policing system, the prison system, the welfare system, the family policing system or child welfare system. Again, if you look at the history, for example, of the 1990s, there is now a neoliberal and effort by a bipartisan support for by Democrats and Republicans to be harsher on Black communities. And that took the form of the Crime Control Bill of 1993 that funded police departments more and that sent more and more police into Black communities. Then there was the 1996 law that restructured welfare. Basically, well, it did. It didn't basically. It abolished the federal entitlement to welfare. Now, the first law was based on these ideas of Black super predators and Black children who grew up to be criminals. The second law, the
Thank God
welfare,
those people aren't around anymore.
The welfare restructuring law, right, exactly. The welfare restructuring law was based on the, or fueled by anyway, the image of the Black welfare queen who supposedly had children just to get a welfare check, and then she completely neglected her children and used the money on herself, right? So that was 1996. 1997, a law that fewer people are aware of, the Adoption and Safe Families Act, 1 year later, all of these signed by President Clinton in a bipartisan effort to be tough on crime, that dealt with this expanding foster care population, which disproportionately was based on separating Black children from their homes. And this idea came out that Black children were languishing in foster care. I'm using some of the language that was used then, languishing in foster care, that the state needed to free them from their parents, they could be adopted by better families. And some people explicitly said by white families who would take better care of them. And so that led to a law that speeds up termination of parental rights and gives bonuses, incentives to states to place children out of foster care into adoptive homes. So here again, we see this convergence of these punitive systems, but also the politics of it that's based on this idea that Black families are dysfunctional, they don't take good care of their children, there's not a lot of harm if you separate them from children from their families, and that Black communities and all of society will be better off as a result of this. Also, I'll point out that these are all based on the idea that government shouldn't support us, you know, that welfare is bad, that resources shouldn't be generously given to families and other people in need, and that instead we should rely on low-wage work, marriage, not having so many children. These were all explicit objectives of welfare restructuring, and in a way, the Adoption Safe Families Act, which said, okay, if we're ending welfare as we know it, and if families can't survive, and this is disproportionately Black families who are living in poverty, Black childhood poverty much greater than poverty of white children in America, although both are is abysmal and should be an embarrassment to this nation. Absolutely. But they can't survive. Okay, we'll take their children, terminate their rights, and put them into more privileged homes. So you could see how these ideas fit together as punitive, carceral approaches to people's needs that are caused by an unequal society, but blaming them and punishing them instead of turning to what would actually be more supportive and safer for children. I mean, let's be honest, the biggest harm to children in America is not their parents neglecting them. It's our society neglecting them. Right. You know, we have the highest child poverty rate of any Western nation. You know, we're a wealthy nation, but that wealth is not distributed, certainly not to children in marginalized communities, especially Black and Indigenous communities, and also many impoverished white communities as well. And we're also the nation that takes children away at the highest rates, that terminates parental rights at the highest rates.
And it's such wildly arbitrary. I mean, some of the stories, and by the way, the stories in this text, the examples are so rich. They make you want to throw the book at times because you're so frustrated at what's happening. I mean, there's this story you tell of a woman whose child gets away from her. She runs sort of in front, and anybody mm-hmm. with children knows sometimes your kid's going to run in front of you.
Yeah.
And sometimes you're tired. You might not get quite. It might take you an extra 30, 40 seconds to get there. You know where they are, and that's fine.
Right. She could see them.
She was no more than a minute away.
Yeah.
But someone, a bystander, I won't give her a name, but we could assign an arbitrary name, decides to intervene and calls the police.
Calls 911.
And refuses to give this child back to her mother.
Yep.
And the mother is too exhausted and worn out for all the reasons.
She's undergoing testing for leukemia because
right.
she's so thin, and she has she also has asthma. So she is a frail, she's 25 years old, a nursing student.
Yeah.
Should I pick up on the story?
Please.
Okay. So.
You know better than me.
Right. So and she wouldn't mind me. I have her name. Her name is Vanessa Peoples.
Yeah.
Vanessa Peoples.
This is the story that set me off.
Yeah, Vanessa Peoples, 25 years old, trying to manage two little kids who live in a loving home with her mother and her husband. And the little boy traipses away when her cousin leaves the picnic. Okay, they're at a family picnic. You can imagine the cousin goes away and the little boy traipses after her. Now, Vanessa can see that this is happening. She's got the other son, so she runs after her little boy, and she can see this woman on the phone calling 911. She says to her, I'm the mother, this is my child. The woman refuses to give her son back to her. And when the police come, they won't believe her that she's the mother of this child. She has to bring her family over to vouch for her. But that's, okay, again, in a wealthy neighborhood, first of all, they wouldn't call the police,
right.
but fine. End of beautiful story, child is back with the mother. No, the police officer gives her a ticket for child abuse.
Child neglect, yeah.
Yeah, well, it's actually child. It should have been neglect.
It was actually abuse.
It was actually abuse because this is, I know, I have to correct this in the text, actually, because it was neglect. All she did was neglect the child. She didn't abuse the child. But in Colorado, there's misdemeanor child abuse, which does not require any evidence of harm to the child. Okay, so now she's got a criminal ticket. All right, a month later, she's down in the basement, washing clothes, cleaning up. Her two boys are upstairs, and a caseworker comes to the door. She doesn't hear. She's hard of hearing in one ear. She doesn't hear, and one of the same little boy is in the window, and the caseworker decides she's concerned that some neglect is going on in the home. And so she calls the police to assist her in entering the home. Three police officers show up. All right, one of them, they go in the house, one of them with a gun pointed down the stairs, confronts her coming up the stairs. Already you can imagine the trauma that this family has already experienced. They start to interrogate her. And she says, "You can see my children are fine. Will you please leave?" No, they won't leave. They start to inspect her house. She's saying, "Please, we're fine. Leave us alone." She's a little mouthy. She says, they say, "Well, you need a way to care for your children." She says, "I am caring for my children." And they said, "Well, you could have been sick." She said, "I am sick, but you're not helping me." You know, and they didn't like the fact that she was asking them to leave. And so she calls her mother to come help. And the mother arrives and also says, "Leave us alone." the mother takes the children into the bedroom to try to get them ready and separate them from these police. And a police officer says, you cannot be in the bedroom alone with your grandchildren. So now there's four police officers because they've called for backup. Vanessa starts yelling at the police officer, let me see my mother. You have to let me in. And he's saying, stand back, stand back, stand back. He then grabs her by the throat. And this is all on body cam. I've unfortunately had to watch every police officer's body camera. Yeah. But grabs her by the throat, throws her to the ground, and three police officers jump on top of her, lurch her arms to the back where she's handcuffed behind, dislocating her shoulder, handcuff or chain her ankles, and then take a chain, and this is called hobbling, hobble her so that her legs and her arms are twisted to the back. And then they carry her like that. She says, I felt like I was an animal being carried out like this, and put her in the police car. By this time, seven police officers have arrived at her home. Mind you, this stems from her little boy straying away for a minute. Okay, seven police officers arrive. She's eventually advised to plead guilty to a child abuse charge so she can avoid jail. She's put in jail until her mother can bail her out, and then she pleads guilty. She's supervised for a year where she has to have supervised visitation with her children. And just to cut to the terrible ending, she now cannot get a job as a nurse. That's what she was training for, because she's on the child abuse registry in Colorado. She cannot find an apartment of her own, because every time she applies, they find out that she's on the child abuse registry and tell her, we can't have a child abuser living in this building. She's traumatized. Her children have nightmares. She cringes every time she sees a police officer. And this story, I think, is so reflective of how police and caseworkers work together, how they terrorize families, and how they don't address the needs of families. They did absolutely nothing to help her children. All they did was traumatize them and now make it harder for her to take care of them because she can't get the job she was trained for and she has trouble finding housing. It's a horrible, horrible story, but it's not an isolation. Right. It's not an aberration.
It's not exceptional. Yeah.
Yeah.
But we're going to take audience questions. I just have one more question. We can't stop on that note.
No. Yeah.
Particularly because this is an abolitionist text.
Yes, exactly.
And when I talk about abolition, I always say that we begin with the question of what would the world look like if all of our needs were met?
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
It's an affirmative vision. It's not just what we don't want.
Exactly.
It's what we do want.
Exactly.
So as you go from shattered bonds to torn apart,
yeah,
what is the world we want?
Yeah. Yeah, we don't want a world that continues to treat children's needs by accusing their parents, investigating them, traumatizing them, taking children away from their homes, putting them in a violent foster care system. And we won't have time for me, maybe questions, you can ask questions about it, but believe me, there are children killed in, and I give examples of that, including right here in Philadelphia, a 16-year-old boy who was killed at Wordsworth, so-called Wordsworth Academy, not too long ago when the staff came in looking for a missing iPad and they ended up killing him. And that's not the only case, but also massive violence and abuse in foster care. We don't want that. That hasn't stopped child neglect or maltreatment, other forms of maltreatment, and it has caused a lot of suffering in especially Black and Indigenous communities and other impoverished communities, marginalized people in general, because I also think of Governor Abbott's in Texas, his directive to Child Protective Services to investigate the families that provide gender-affirming care. So you see how this can be used as a weapon against political dissent, against nonconforming people. And against communities as a whole. Okay, so we don't want that. We don't want that. We want to dismantle that, but at the very same time, we want children to be safer. We want families to be supported. We want people's needs to be met. That's the goal. And so we need to be building a completely different approach that supports families with the concrete resources they need, with housing. You know, with food, with clothing, with better education. The part of the reason why children suffer from educational neglect, you know, it's not because of their parents. The main reason is because we have a school system that is deeply inequitable, yes. Deeply. And we could just look at Philadelphia. You know, it reminds me when I came to Philadelphia, I brought along a middle schooler. My son was going to enter middle school, and literally a professor at Wharton I met with while I was being recruited told me, "Oh, you can't send your son to the Philadelphia public schools. That would be child abuse." Those are her exact words. That would be child abuse. Wow. And you know, it's abuse by the state, not by the parents. But so all of these needs, including income supports, we know, for example, that the Biden administration's ways of getting cash into people's hands, parents' hands, during the COVID pandemic, which now is probably going to end because Congress won't fund it. Right. But we know that that reduced poverty, child poverty. We also know that the best way to reduce childhood poverty and harms to children is simply to increase the incomes of parents. You know, go figure, exactly. Do we need a study? But study after study, you know, shows this. And so we know ways that would support children and families better, including community-based mutual aid that actually provides in a non-coercive way what families need. This is not what family policing systems offer. We also know that there are better ways of reducing violence in families, whether it's violence against adults or violence against children, intimate violence, than taking children away or locking people up. Black anti-carceral feminists, for example, have been arguing for this for a long time. People in the movement to abolish the prison industrial complex, and also importantly, survivors of violence. You know, there are organizations and books you can read by survivors of family violence who write that they wish that there were a way of dealing with the violence that didn't cause a disruption of prisons and family separation. And it's called transformative justice. Some people might have other terms for it. But there are better ways that actually get at the roots of why we have violence in families. We know now that locking people up and putting children in foster care does not end violence. In fact, most of the cases we hear about that involve tragic deaths of children in their homes, which should not happen, but they usually, you see, child known to system was killed. All right, that means the system failed. So for some reason, though, the response when this happens in cities is to now say, oh, we need more family intervention. Right. We need more money given to the system. We need caseworkers to take more children away. And all that does is now overwhelm caseworkers so they're less likely to find the cases of extreme abuse that might lead to deaths or, you know, really serious harms to children. It doesn't help. We have to find a radically different way of how to address violence. And it would help as well to relieve families of the stresses caused by deep poverty, which exists. You know, Philadelphia, for example, I believe is still the poorest big city in the nation. It also, at least as of statistics in 2017, has the highest rate of child removal of any big city in America.
Wow.
And by the way, the city council earlier this month produced a report based on hearings it had of child separation. And the report calls for a massive overhaul of DHS, including ending mandated reporting, including ending taking children based on anonymous tips, including providing adequate high-quality legal representation to parents and family caregivers, and other kinds of recommendations.
Wow. So that's the type of powerful vision forward that we need order to move. Let's take some questions. I think we have time for a few. Andy, are you going to... Yes, he is the mic.
Good.
You ended looking at a forward view of a society in which needs are met and children are valued. And it's true that during COVID there was an example of government that could meet needs. I mean, putting money in people's pockets and an actual visible, trackable improvement in people's lives.
Yeah.
But that's not happening.
Yeah.
And my question, I think, is, given the unlikeliness of the American society as it is now, going through a big overhaul and becoming a supportive society that would meet the needs of families, we need to talk about how, I'd like to hear you talk more about how you balance the process in a society that isn't going to provide the economic support, where, in truth, there are kids who get abused. And while poverty is a huge part of it, it's not all of it. And there are social workers who really care and who are connected to the families and maybe even more connected to mom than to the kids' needs or the community. Where do we go from here?
This is the classic question posed to abolitionists all the time, right?
Yeah.
What about the harm that happens?
Right.
We need systems and oversights and protections.
Right.
What do we do in real time while people are suffering
at
the same time that we want to build toward this other thing?
Well, but children are also suffering. Families are also suffering in the system we have now. So we can't ignore the suffering that's going on now because we're afraid that we can't build a society that would end that suffering. So I prefer to look at it as we have a system that's causing harm right now. I want to stop that harm from occurring. Just as much as I want to stop the harm that's occurring in homes. I mean, both I want to stop. I don't think we should say, well, we have to protect children in their homes, so we're going to put them into a system that also harms them. You know, I want to stop the deaths of Black teenagers who are put disproportionately into so-called residential treatment centers where staff treat them as if they're criminals. You know, as if they've committed crimes. Not to say that anyone should be treated that way. No child should be treated that way. But that's how they're treated. I want to stop the unnecessary separation and trauma to families, including children, who suffer because of this. So I'm just not willing to say, well, let's sacrifice all these children and families that are being harmed now because we can't imagine a better way of doing it. Or we don't think that would happen. Now, I agree. It's going to take a lot of work and a lot of transformation to create the society that many of us would envision that truly is equitable, you know, that truly has gotten rid of structural racism and poverty and other forms of extremely harmful inequities. That it takes a lot. And in fact, there are some people who have argued with me that we have to do that. That's what we should do first. Let's forget about fixing these systems, which I don't agree with fixing them. But let's, you know, I gave a talk at Revolution Books in New York City in Harlem on Sunday, and there was a revolutionary there who was saying, you know, let's forget about these systems. We need a massive revolution in America. Well, I agree we need a revolution in America, but actually I'm somewhere maybe in between you and this person where I say, we need to stop the suffering going on right now by people who are entangled in this system. And we can do that. So I think we can do both. I think we can dismantle the system piece by piece. We can reduce the suffering of people in the system now, as we are simultaneously working toward a replacement for it. So, for example, there are many mandated reporters, teachers and doctors and others who feel they have to call the child abuse hotline in order to get the services and the resources that children need. If there were another way of getting them those resources and services without having to call this investigative, accusatory, punitive system, they would prefer to do that. And this is something that even the city council wrote in the report. They want to end mandated reporting. It's not true that ending it is going to limit the ability of people who are in caring professions to care. It actually frees them mm-hmm. to care without having to subject families to a damaging system. That's just one example of the kinds of things we can do today to work toward it. And then at the same time, we can be working toward a massive transformation, whether you want to call it a revolution, radical change. I happen to believe that radical change can happen. You know, during, you may think this is a stretch, but certainly during the slavery era, there were many people, maybe most people in America, thought that America could never exist without slavery. It took a struggle of hundreds of years of a lot of sacrifice to do it, but there was an abolition of slavery. Now, yes, we recognize that there are ways in which many of the ideas behind enslaving people continue today, that there are forms of forced labor and oppression that continue today. But we still should recognize that the massive movement and activism and sacrifice of Black people who were enslaved, who despite that fought for their freedom, did end up liberating Black people from enslavement. It can happen. And so my approach is to say we have a system that is oppressive, that is causing suffering. We need to end it as soon as we can. We need to work toward that. And we should maintain a vision. Maybe none of us will see it materialize. Hopefully some of us will. But a vision of a society that doesn't punish people to meet their needs, that doesn't excuse deep inequities by blaming the people who are most disadvantaged by them. I believe that we can achieve that, or our children or great-grandchildren or great-great-grandchildren yeah. can achieve that, but only by doing that, can we ever have any hope of ending the suffering that's taking place right now, that people are rising up against. And I think we have to, I'm sorry to go on, but I think we have to appreciate that there are people who have been grievously harmed, parents and children who have been grievously harmed, who are calling on us to abolish this system. I don't want to ignore them. I would rather follow them than the people who say, oh, we have to keep it. It's flawed, but we need to keep it. We need to keep its design. No, I'm with the people who have suffered and are telling us that we need to make a radical change in this system. In fact, we need to dismantle it and replace it with something that truly supports families and keeps children safe.
Amen. The book is called Torn Apart, How the Child Welfare System Destroys Black Families and How Abolition Can Build a Safer World. Dorothy Roberts, can you please give a round of applause?
Oh, thank you. Thanks. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.